Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Prospects for peace and prosperity on the Korean Peninsula continues, with Andy Downs asking about the transitions in power from one member of the Kim family to another. Thank you for listening.
Have there been concerns, for example, Jamie, when we moved in 2011 to Kim Jong-un as the Supreme Leader? What are the concerns like during these moments of transition?
Well, I think the concerns are animated even more than usual by our incredible lack of knowledge of what's really going on inside the regime. And I say incredible not in a critical way. There's just it's very difficult even for our experts to know what's going on inside the regime. So when Kim Jong-un took over in 2011, we really didn't know much about him. And, you know, he was very young. He was very inexperienced. We knew very little even about his own sort of personal life and family life. And so, you know, many of our viewers will remember the Kremlinology of the Cold War era, right, where we tried to sort of judge what was going on behind the scenes in the Soviet Union by judging, for example, you know, what officials were sitting closer to Brezhnev on the parade viewing stand. But we knew so much more about the Soviet Union back then than we know about North Korea now. So much of this is learning even a lot of basic information. And surely our intelligence services know more than any of us do. But, you know, but the word is they don't really know much either. They know as much as can be learned from the most closed society on Earth.
What's interesting here, though, is when you look at, for example, the Soviet Union, there was an attempt to put all this on display. I mean, we were able to look at photos, for example, yeah. Decide who was sitting closer and what that meant. Here, we're talking about something that is incredibly isolated, with very, very tight control, very little information creeping across the border in any way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. really, when it comes right down to it.
Yeah.
I know, Sheena, you've actually met some North Korean defectors.
Yes.
And when they have, when you've met them, what have conversations been like? I mean, are these folks who were a little bit older, a little bit younger? Were they there during each Kim's rule? What sort of information do they have for you?
I met the various age people, older as 50s, 60s, or young as college students. And nowadays, I think there is a direct flight. They go to China and then just immediately coming over there mm-hmm. with that.
In terms of transition, do the folks living in North Korea, have they been concerned during these transition periods? Has anyone ever talked to you about that? Or for that matter, what's information like when they come to tell you what life is like? Are you surprised by what they have to say? Is this all new information when they're talking to you about what life is like?
Lately, there is many of TV or media talking about this North Korean experience, and also they have their own website, and then so there is so much of information available for those who are interested. What is really surprising is there, in spite of this tight control, there is information available. Mm-hmm. And they hear this South Korean news or pop culture through. Although they are forbidden in cost of all that, they are accessing it, and then they are more aware of those of what is going on in outside world.
Mm-hmm. Of course, part of that's thanks to newer technology that makes it possible to find those things out. It's been 65-ish years since the Korean War. In historical terms, that's not very long. In other ways of looking at that, that's quite a while ago. When we think about how things have changed. Have they really changed in terms of the nature of the relationship, at least on the international stage, with North Korea over the 65 years?
I think clearly, initially, once North Korea was defeated in the Korean War, it became, from the U.S. perspective and even the world perspective, a relatively marginal actor. Attention was focused on the People's Republic of China and under Richard Nixon and bringing China into the world system, and probably kind of the assumption that reestablishing relations between the United States and China would in some ways bring North Korea into the system as well as kind of a satellite of China. And so for a fairly long period of time, because North Korea was not a military threat, it was largely ignored.
But was it a good assumption to think that North Korea would be brought into the fold as China, or into the international, on the international stage as China did, since its relationship was as much with the Soviet Union as it was with China?
I think so, because there was also increasing interactions between Eastern Europe, which was clearly Russian satellites and not in any way, shape, or form Chinese satellites, so that the Soviet Union was permitting the East European countries to have greater contacts with the West, so there would seem to be no reason to assume that they would, that the Soviet Union would create any barriers to North Korea developing at least more contacts in Eastern Asia. It would seem to be the case that that was an internal decision in North Korea, which I don't think was anticipated, or it wasn't anticipated that it would continue on under a cessation of leaders in the way in which it did.
Now, obviously, because it's a more international country, South Korea is a much more diverse population than it was in 1945, 1948, and it's growing in its diversity. What are some of the major differences that we see today compared to North Korea? Sheena?
I believe every aspect of Korea, South Korea, and North Korea, like so contrasting. Politically, the South Korea is a thriving democracy. Recently, they have impeached the sitting president.
Right, right.
Yes, yeah. And the, there is a great civic movement, and the socially and culturally, they are very much diverse. Also, so South Korea enjoys the soft culture, soft power of the cultural Korean wave and their pop culture, mm-hmm. Drama, music, game, online games, mm-hmm. and Korean cuisine, all that kind of things. They are very much popular throughout Asia, and I think it is expanding. So they have a tremendous soft power they are enjoying, mm-hmm. and that is translating into economy, economic power as well. And the South Korea is, I think it's the 20th in the world that the many the tourists visit. So, and of course, South Koreans visit outside also. Mm-hmm. So it's very much open, and economically, they are about 40 times of North Korea in all aspects. We have same ethnic background and linguistic background, cultural, historical ties. But the, if you're looking at the current way of life, they are so much apart, one end to the other, mm-hmm. extreme. Yeah.
You mentioned before defectors who you have met. Historically, when someone defects from North Korea and actually comes into South Korea, what's that like? Is it sort of like the Cold War example where obviously the Soviet Union was always happy to get defectors from the United States and they played them up and it became part of propaganda? Same for the U.S. when it would have a Soviet defector, they would make big news about that. Did South Korea make a big deal out of northern defectors?
Actually, it was, but no longer. During the 70s, until 70s, when the economy was approximately similar to one another, when there is a defection, it was a political thing. So they make a big deal and then propaganda every day, everywhere on there. Once that the Korean economy faster paced North Korea, then that is not the issue anymore. It is more of South Korea have to provide for these defectors.
So now it's a burden.
Yeah.
Interesting. So but when decades ago, if someone came across the border, they would almost have celebrity status then.
Yes,
they
yes.
would have been
well cared
for.
Yes, so very much rewarded in economically and also. But okay. Now those rewards are much less. And there is a special program for them to go through to adjust in South Korean life.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason to be optimistic about the possibility of North and South Korea, if not combining into a single Korea, at least having a more beneficial relationship, a better relationship than they have had for the last decade or so, do you think?
I heard the people talking about the mutually beneficial arrangement, like a South Korean technology, North Korean workmanship, labor, because they are actually very well-educated people, and they can, they have a very good work ethics and etc. It is just that their regime did not really provide the opportunity for them to do so. Mm-hmm. So instead of just going into South Korean industry, was going into China, Vietnam, and everywhere else, and there is talk that maybe North Korea is a much better choice. After all, you have to you have to provide for them one way or the other if they are going to coexist.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, this is in some respects about economy, isn't it? I mean, any market is a good market to expand into, Jim? Is that a way to look at it?
Probably, yeah, virtually any market. And I think that for South Korea, North Korea would be obviously a viable market. And we've seen some indications under the current South Korean president of an effort to open to the North, to extend opportunities, feelers, to improve relations, as opposed to what was more historically a more antagonistic approach from both sides. And the North would be provocative, and the South, with U.S. support, would be equally provocative under a variety of presidents in both countries. If the North did something, then the United States and South Korea would have joint military exercises to send a message back.
And, of course, one of the big examples of this was the Olympics. But before we get there, we should talk about some of the things that happened in the second half of 2017, which, for many people, raised the fear level an awful lot. North Korea demonstrated some missile capacity that was not expected. They have demonstrated the ability to, we know that they have some nuclear capability. But in the end, this is something that was more than a little bit disconcerting for the United States. But disconcerting, I think, for just about everybody. Sheena, in terms of people living in South Korea, when the United States was suddenly becoming concerned about these missiles, was there much of a reaction in South Korea?
Of course, they are the immediate. If something happened, they are the immediate casualties. So they are keenly aware of it. However, their reaction is much more calm because I was talking to my family and they were saying, where are we going to hide?
And in some respects, this is rather flippant of me to say, maybe even safer because now missiles can reach further. So there are other targets. The venom is being spread around in a very cynical way by my statement there. What's the international reaction to the missile tests and the possibility of nuclear capabilities, Jim?
I think that there's, given the issues between the United States and North Korea, there's always the danger of escalation, there's always the danger of a misstep, of misunderstanding that could get out of hand. And I think although South Korea, I mean, is immune probably from a missile attack, because it would be hard to, Seoul is so close to the border of North Korea that using a nuclear missile against Seoul, which would be counterproductive, given your own territory. But any kind of misstep or perception of misstep, which is different than a misstep, by North Korea, which might lead to military action by the United States against surgical airstrikes is the term that is used, although they're not all that surgical, more surgical now than in the past when they were used. The fallout, both political and literal, on South Korea would be immense. There would be no way for South Korea to avoid negative aspects of a military strike against the North, and with thousands of North Korean military artillery pieces focused on the South. Clearly, if there was an attack against the North, there would be an expectation the North would retaliate against the South, so the South would suffer regardless. So I think the fear of an escalating confrontation between South Korea and the United States, or between North Korea and the United States, would have negative fallout, particularly for South Korea, but also potentially for Japan, and maybe even for China, which would, because of prevailing, I don't know what the prevailing wind currents are in Northeast Asia, but it would be hard for China to remain totally uninvolved or to side with the United States in that kind of situation.
Mutually assured destruction is a term that we hear quite often, and obviously part of the rhetoric that we heard between North Korea and the United States in the second half of 2017 sort of pushed us in that direction. Is deterrence really the way to go?
I think deterrence is the only way to go. And you know, when we what this does is raise the fundamental question: why does North Korea want its nuclear weapons? Why is it developing its nuclear weapons? And, you know, there are a small number of reasons why countries seem to develop nuclear weapons, and not that many countries have them. North Korea is only the ninth. Most countries want nothing to do with these very dangerous weapons. So why does North Korea want nuclear weapons? Well, deterrence is widely considered to be the number one reason, because the North Korean regime is worried about an attack by the United States. Maybe rightly, maybe wrongly, maybe, you know, paranoid to an extreme, whatever, but still that seems to be a very important driving factor. It's important to remember North Korea's location. You don't have to sympathize at all with this ruthless regime to appreciate that it's sitting in a very dangerous part of the world. It has a nuclear-armed China on one border, a nuclear-armed Russia on another border, and on its only other border, the third border, is South Korea, which is backed by the U.S. nuclear umbrella and has U.S. forces stationed there. It's a very dangerous area, and even though the North Korean fears of U.S. invasion are you know, quite vastly overblown in normal times, it's comprehensible that why North Korea might want the ultimate weapon, because it's generally, you know, agreed that once you have nuclear weapons, you're a lot harder to attack. The point is that from a U.S. perspective, if we're worried about the possibility of being attacked by nuclear weapons from North Korea, we have to ask ourselves, is deterrence enough to keep the North Koreans from launching weapons to the United States? And we have to kind of hope that it is. In other words, that North Korea is worried enough about U.S. retaliation that it won't shoot off its weapons. And, you know, we'll talk a bit more about this in a few minutes, probably about what the prospects are for denuclearizing the peninsula. But I think, you know, the prospects for that are quite slim. So for the time being, the mutual logic of deterrence on both sides seems to be driving this dynamic.
Our panel discussion will conclude after a short break. Stay tuned.